on January the 11th, 1827, in Charleston, South Carolina, James Pettigrew Boyce was born. Because of his part in the establishment of this institution in Greenville, South Carolina, opening its doors in 1859, it has been customary on the anniversary of the birthday of James Pettigrew Boyce, or as near thereto as possible, and we are very near thereto since this is the precise anniversary, to celebrate that day in the life of the seminary as Founders Day. And so this morning, we are to hear Dr. J.B. Weatherspoon, who in 1929 succeeded Dr. Charles Spurgeon Gardner as professor of preaching in this institution, deliver the Founders Day address to us on Charles Spurgeon Gardner. Dr. Weatherspoon.
This is a time when one has his place in the sun. First, I must speak a personal word, trying to say how greatly I appreciate the privilege that I have this morning of speaking to you about my old professor, my friend, my predecessor. I'm among a very few on the campus who studied with Dr. Gardner. If it would not be so misleading as to my own age, I would say that I entered as a student the year he entered as professor. 1907. But I looked back and there came Gaines S. Dobbins the next year. A little later came Prof. Johnson. And a little later, nearly two decades later, W.W. Adams. These four, I think, are the only ones left on the campus who were his students. Two of them were his colleagues, Dr. Dobbins, Professor Johnson. And I wish to express my appreciation to these more aged members of the faculty. For the very kind way in which they have given me their impressions of Dr. Gardner, adding to my own and confirming some things that I had in mind already. I'll express once for all my appreciation to them without noting where their help appears. In the hands of a student of Charles Spurgeon Gardner, and I may say to my students, this isn't a sermon. In the hands of a student of Charles Spurgeon Gardner, a review of his career could easily abound in praise and expressions of personal appreciation. But the knowledge of his spirit makes restraint appropriate. His preference would be that what is said should be more about the character of his work than about his personal excellences. There was enough in his experience to make him a vain man. But instead of dramatizing his triumphs with heroic gesture, he quietly set himself to the enlarging tasks found within the doors of service that opened before him. My purpose, therefore, is not a personal eulogy, but a review of significant steps in his career and what he did and taught in an effort to make him known to you who did not have the privilege of sitting at his feet. It is necessary first to take a brief look at his family background, which had a good deal to do with his spirit and character and outlook on life, his early faith, his readiness to enter the ministry, his pursuit of culture, his attitudes in a world of rapid intellectual and social change, his sympathy and gentleness of manner owed much to the providence of his parentage and upbringing. He was born February 28, 1859, in Gibson County, Tennessee, into the home of Stephen A. Gardner and Evelyn Wood Gardner, daughter of the editor of a Baptist paper in Georgia. That home was a good cradle for the man that was to be. It was poor in the things that perish, but rich in the things that are eternal. Stephen Gardner, whose English father and Irish mother had come to America and settled near Providence, Rhode Island, was educated at Brown University. In the migrating spirit of his father, he early moved into the South, finally settling in West Tennessee under the urgent persuasion of another Baptist preacher, J.R. Graves. He was invited by Dr. Graves to join him as associate editor of a paper he was publishing. This was declined, however, on the ground of a preference for teaching or preaching. Thus, Stephen Gardner came to join that hardy pioneer group of farmer preachers that 100 years ago blazed the way in the South and West for Baptist growth. Into this home was born Charles Spurgeon Gardner, the youngest of six children, one brother significantly bearing also the name of a preacher, Francis Wayland. One would like to comment on the significance of that trio, Graves, Spurgeon, and Wayland, living together in the esteem of Stephen Gardner in 1859, but time forbids. 2 months after the birth of Charles, Stephen Gardner died. The oldest son, William, assumed the responsibility of headship and held the family together under the care of the mother until after Charles was ready to go to college. He surrendered his hope of a formal education, but later capitalized on his experience at home by establishing an orphanage in Arkansas. One incident that Dr. Gardner cherished, which was significant of his brother's care and also for his own experience, was his being taken to the railroad station to meet Dr. John A. Broadus, who was passing through. The boy was thrilled at meeting the great man and having him express the hope that someday he might study at the seminary. As one follows the story of the Gardner family through the years, one is impressed with its fundamental wealth in faith, character, and culture. Dating from the grandfather who emigrated from England to America, no Gardner seemed willing to die where he was born. And that was true not only geographically, but intellectually and spiritually. No insulation, whether by circumstance or established ways or intellectual tradition, was permitted to seal the door against a larger life in a larger world. Into such a company was Charles Spurgeon Gardner born. In 1877, he entered Union University at Jackson, Tennessee. After 4 years and without graduation, for he had no adequate high school to prepare him for college, he transferred to Richmond College in Virginia, where he found a different background and a new orientation. For reasons outside his own desire and intellectual ability, he had again to move on without a degree. In 1882, he entered the seminary to study primarily with Dr. Broadus, whom he had met when he was a boy. He was able to stay but 1 year, but gave care to take, among other courses, every course that Dr. Broadus gave, Greek, New Testament interpretation, and homiletics. In these academic years, he received no badge of achievement, but he received something without which any degree is worth less than nothing. He received a passion for study, a knowledge of how to study and what to study as a preacher of the gospel. With this, his education had begun. Its increase would continue to enrich his life and ministry as long as he lived. If his father was a farmer preacher, he was a student preacher, giving himself with equal energy to plowing, planting, reaping, and storing up for the people he served. Having been ordained at Newcastle, Kentucky, while a seminary student, he was ready to assume full-time pastoral duties. There were two brief pastorates at Trenton and Brownsville, Tennessee. While at Brownsville, he met and married Miss Ariadne Turner, who until her death in 1914 fully shared his dedication to the service of Christ. The dedication of one of his books reads as follows: "To the memory of Ellen Wood Gardner, my mother, and Ariadne Turner Gardner, my wife, to each of whom I owe a debt of gratitude too great for words." After Brownsville came the pastorate of 8 years, 1886 to 94, at the Edgefield Baptist Church in Nashville. It's a matter of historical interest that during this pastorate, the Sunday School Board of the Southern Baptist Convention was established, and in the list of the first board of managers was the name C.S. Gardner. In this early responsibility may be found the roots of his great concern for the educational function of the church and for the ministry of the Sunday School Board, whose influence he did not underestimate. Then followed the pastorates at Greenville, South Carolina, 1894-1901, where this seminary was established in 1859, the year of Dr. Gardner's birth, a fact concerning which he later said with characteristic modesty, "That means nothing to the seminary, of course, but a great deal to me." In the First Baptist Church there, he was in close touch with Furman University and rendered a most acceptable service to faculty and students in addition to his ministry in the whole community. A series of 5 articles in the Religious Herald of Virginia in 1904 on the question, "Is Christian education essential to the work of evangelization?" reflects how seriously and profoundly he gave himself to the subject of denominational education during the Greenville pastorate. In one article, he discussed the question from the standpoint of its teacher, of the teacher. In another, from the standpoint of the student facing the problems of science, criticism, and skepticism. In a third, he approached the question historically. Again, his discussion was in the light of the state program of higher education. And finally, he spoke from the standpoint of the denomination with the problems of organization and control. Written 50 years ago, his affirmations and arguments are still challenging. Beginning with the thesis that the type of education prevailing largely determines the type of religious life that will prevail, he argued for the Christian school as the necessary agency for the perpetuation of an evangelical type of Christianity. And the mission of the Christian school, he believed to be to make culture center around Christ, which entailed, quote, "a correlation of modern scientific knowledge and habits of mind with the vital elements of the Christian faith." The Greenville pastorate provided a constant stimulus for study, and to the study of subjects calculated to increase the preacher's effectiveness in his ministry to the whole community, to individuals, student, professor, businessman, farmer, in their personal awakening and development, and also to life in community. He studied diligently, not in order that he might become a scholar, but a preacher unashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Thus the foundations were strengthened for that comprehensive grasp of the things that pertain to life, which was to become the strength and attractiveness of his teaching. From Greenville, after 6 years, the journey led to the Grace Street Church in Richmond, Virginia. This pastorate extended from 1901 to 1907, when Dr. Gardiner was invited to a professorship in the seminary. And we may from this time properly call him Dr. Gardiner, for Union University had already given him the degree of Doctor of Divinity, a fact which he somehow failed to report to Who's Who in America, as he did also the other honorary degrees that were later bestowed on him. The form of his ministry in Richmond did not show any distinct change. The quality of it, however, was constantly enriched. He became known as an outstanding preacher whose sermons reflected a careful and accurate interpretation of biblical truth, an intimate and sympathetic understanding of life with its intellectual, moral, and spiritual problems, and a clear discernment of the meeting place of man's need and God's supply. People forgave him for not aspiring to brilliant oratory because he fed their minds and hearts with a sympathy and urgency that stirred their consciences and drew them to higher levels of understanding and life. His preaching was dynamic rather than pyrotechnic. He preached on no petty themes. He resorted neither to artfulness nor to triviality to entertain the crowds. He believed too seriously in the sacredness of personality and knew too much about psychology and religious experience to trip men into superficial response. On the other hand, his pulpit had nothing in common with a morgue. There was nothing wintry or dead about him. He was alive, and the truth he preached was living, throbbing truth. His was the vitality of a strong, vigorous planter, sowing seed with a purposeful and hopeful heart, not that of a butterfly or bumblebee, seeking sweets and enjoying praise of his wings or his bumble. There was no vanity in him. Neither was there any fear. He did not shrink from opening new vistas of truth or cutting across old ways of interpreting Christian life. He often preached truth that burned, not in the defiant spirit of an innovator, but with the simple directness of one who had come upon something vital that in good conscience must be told. I recall vividly a chapel talk on the affirmation of John the Baptist, "Even now the axe lieth at the root of the tree." And his sermon at the Southern Baptist Convention in 1911, in which he preached about the kingdom of God, a subject on which there was wide disagreement with many ramifications. In the straightforward manner of an expositor rather than debater, he made his interpretation of the kingdom and pinned his vast audience down to the question of Jesus, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say?" In the pulpit, Dr. Gardiner presented a picture of calm self-possession. His face expressed friendliness, much like that one sees in a portrait of Alexander McLaren or Phillips Brooks. His manner was deliberate, nothing nervous or fussy. All who knew him remembered that he was never in a hurry, but nevertheless began and ended promptly. His speech was as personal as conversation, but maintained the dignity of occasion. His voice was not mellow or honeyed, and yet not harsh. In the midst of a sermon, it easily registered triumph or concern, or the ring of insistence or warning, as well as the positiveness of confident proclamation. His gestures were not many and served the purpose of emphasis more than general dramatic interpretation. All in all, it is fair to say that he was a preacher of great ability, who spoke with strength out of an ample reserve and with full awareness of the needs of men. If one may judge from a very early written sermon and another written in the mid-passage of his ministry, as well as from those one was privileged to hear on various occasions, one characteristic was constant in his preaching. He looked for the central governing aspect of his subject and enlarged upon that to the subordination but not exclusion of others. For example, in a sermon on the character of Aaron that was found among his papers, a sermon written for Dr. Broadus in the class of homiletics, he seized upon the quality of submissiveness in Aaron, illustrating it from several episodes of his life, evaluating it both as strength and as weakness, and pointing out the service that can be rendered by those who, as Dr. Robertson would have expressed it, have to play second fiddle. In red ink, at the end, was this gentle comment in the writing of Dr. Broadus: "You have used your material well and have made a pleasing and effective sermon. Your analysis of his character might have been more exhaustive." He had written on a characteristic rather than the character of Aaron, and he was not the last student to change an assignment to suit himself. When he was professor of homiletics, he gave us, I recall, an assignment to write a paper on the life of Aaron. The other day I found out why. It was a hangover from his own exercise. He did not ask for a sermon, however. It was an exercise in narration. For him, the genius of a sermon was intensiveness rather than expansiveness. Contact with life in a crucial area rather than in general. After 23 years in the pulpit and pastoral ministry, he came to the seminary in 1907. He came as professor of homiletics and ecclesiology, succeeding Dr. E.C. Dargan. Although on this point I have no documentation, I'm quite sure that there was an understanding that he would introduce into the course of study the subjects to which he had given himself for a number of years and which he felt were essential to a minister's preparation in our time: sociology, psychology, and ethics in their joint relationship to preaching. At the first, no new department was proposed, but from the first, infiltration began. The seminary catalogs from 1907 to 1915 furnish interesting reading. I was a member of his class in ecclesiology in 1908-9. The first quarter, as the catalog had indicated, was given to a study of the church as a social institution and its general relation to the whole social organism. The general sociological principles which underlie the genesis and development of social institutions were discussed, and their relation to the whole problem of church polity pointed out. In the second quarter, the subject was comparative church polity, including present-day tendencies and ordinances in the light of the New Testament and the present situation and tendencies in the church. The third quarter was given entirely to the analysis of the social problems of our age, showing the opportunity now wide open for the preacher and the church. In the fourth quarter came a study of church activities in which ethical and sociological principles were applied to the internal problems of the church and its tasks in the outside world, such as evangelism, education, charity, and social reform. That was ecclesiology, with a difference. And you may be assured, both interesting and lively. The next year, 1909-10, two full quarters were given to the social principles of Christianity. In the catalog of 1913-14, the course bears a new title: Ethics and Sociology. ecclesiology having been absorbed in theology and church history, in addition also to student bull sessions. In 1916, appeared a new department bearing the title Christian Sociology, chosen to conform to usage in other institutions. But Dr. Gardner personally preferred the term Sociology of Christianity. Thus, a new department in the seminary's curriculum came into being after having demonstrated its value in ministerial education. In homiletics, Dr. Gardner was no less alert to the value of advancing mental and social sciences. He placed highest value upon the work of Dr. Broaddus in the field of sermon structure, materials of preaching, style, and so forth, and never considered setting it aside. He was aware, however, that the knowledge of mental processes, personality, and conduct had been greatly advanced, and new insights were at hand for the preacher in his task of communication and persuasion. Accordingly, at the very first, he introduced lectures on the psychology of preaching, giving one-third of the course to that subject. These lectures became the basis of a later book entitled Psychology and Preaching, which expounded relevant facts of functional psychology and pointed out the values of psychological understanding for both restraint and guidance in the preacher's evangelistic and didactic objectives. In 1915, Dr. B.H. DeMent, having resigned from the chair of Sunday School Pedagogy, which was then called, Dr. Gardner was asked to take over a part of that work, and besides lecturing on the history of education and educational psychology, conducted a seminar in the psychology of religion, thus having a share in creating the tone and character of two other departments, religious education and psychology of religion. In playing so vital a part in the broadening of practical studies, Dr. Gardner in no way discounted the historical, classical, theological disciplines. No one appreciated more than he the necessity of biblical, historical, and theological knowledge, which provide the materials of our basic faith and message. He had no thought of diluting ministerial education by substituting a practical how for the what and why of sound theological learning. His chief business, however, was with the communication of truth, and his great concern was that the preacher should know people as individual and social personalities, and the character of the social world in which one must preach, together with the ideals of Christian living. He had learned in his own pastoral experience that if preaching is to be permanently effective, the preacher must be psychologically, sociologically, and ethically, as well as theologically intelligent. Only such intelligence could save the preacher from tragic blunders in his proclamation and teaching of the word of life and its claims. That he came to this conclusion early and set himself to diligent study explains his preparedness for the role he was called upon to play in the seminary. His students soon discovered also that Dr. Gardner had an idea that nothing is really understood apart from its history, and that to know the history of an idea or a movement like communism or capitalism or democracy afforded a vantage point from which to judge its strength and weakness, its truth or fallacy. He prefaced his social teaching with a study of the nature and history of social organization. He saw in the history of preaching the preacher's treasure of understanding and inspiration. Books that he required to be read were largely historical in their approach to their subjects. In a seminar, 1910 and 11, on social process, we were required to read such books as Cooley's Social Organization, Forrester's Development of Western Civilization, and Kirkup's History of Socialism. The typist incidentally put that Kickup's History of Socialism, which is very appropriate. In addition to books and lectures that gave an ethical interpretation, he believed that horizon is essential to intelligent criticism and moral leadership. He insisted on an organic view of things. He believed that traditions and customs should be respected as legacies, but held open to examination in the light of new knowledge and experience. In his study of the sciences and history, he discovered the necessity of an open mind, that knowledge grows, that history is in process, that change is essential to progress, and that progress depends upon intelligence and moral integrity. He did not ridicule the closed mind, for he was not given to ridicule. He only exposed its moribund quality. Said he, "The closed mind directs its activities more and more against reality. The beliefs of such a mind represent a certain correlation with a certain order of environing conditions. But this attitude could be justified only on two grounds: that those beliefs represent a perfect correlation with the conditions, and secondly, that those conditions never change." So his students recognized in him that attitude of mind which he recommended to others, in his own words, open-minded conservatism.